With Donald Trump now president, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu might finally have a friend in the White House. Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Barack Obama had a notoriously difficult relationship as the two capitals disagreed on a wide range of issues. This week, Prime Minister Netanyahu met with President Trump for 2 days of meetings, the first meeting between the two men as heads of government. Just before boarding his plane at Ben-Gurion Airport for his flight to Washington, Prime Minister Netanyahu said that U.S.-Israeli relations are strong and will only get stronger.
President Trump and I see eye to eye on the dangers emanating from the region, but also on the opportunities. And we'll talk about both, as well as upgrading the relations between Israel and the United States in many, many fields.
I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. You're listening to The President's Inbox, a CFR podcast that examines the foreign policy challenges facing President Donald Trump. We look at the issues topping his foreign policy inbox and discuss what he has said he will do, what his priorities might be, and what challenges he could likely confront. This week, we're talking about U.S.-Israeli relations and President Trump's meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu. Joining for today's conversation is Rob Dineen, CFR Senior Fellow for Middle East Studies. Rob is a former State Department official with more than 20 years of Middle East experience, including a stint as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs. From 2008 to 2010, he headed the Jerusalem mission of the Quartet Representative Tony Blair. The Quartet is made up of the United States, the United Nations, the European Union, and Russia, and it works on promoting peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Rob, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks, Jim.
Let's start off with the meeting between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump. What happened?
Well, the two men met in a very dramatic and high-profile meeting on Wednesday. And one of the many things that was very interesting about the meeting was the fact that, unlike usual protocol, the two men had their press conference before their meeting rather than after their meeting.
Why do you think that happened?
There are a number of reasons for it. Part of it just had to do with timing, I was told by Israeli reporters, because they scheduled it for 12 noon, which happens to be going into prime time in Israel. And so this was a favor to Prime Minister Netanyahu to have this be able to be broadcast live in prime time in Israel. But I think it also reflects that in many ways, the symbolism of the meeting, the visuals of the meeting, the two men standing side by side in the White House as friends, looking to the future together, that was the message they wanted to convey more than any particular policy issue that they may have discussed.
Okay. I want to get to the domestic politics and the symbolism. Let's sort of put that aside. We'll come back to it. Let's talk about the substance of what came out of the meeting. Going into the meeting, there was a lot of talk about what would happen in terms of discussion of the so-called two-state solution, the issues dealing with Israeli settlements, and also questions of moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. What happened on those dimensions, Rob?
Well, this was, again, very interesting and somewhat unexpected. When it came to the issue of moving the embassy to Jerusalem, President Trump essentially said, I'm looking at it. It's something I really want to do. But essentially hinted that this was something he was in no hurry to do. He's looking at it, would like to move forward. I think he surprised everyone most, and this was what got all the headlines, were his remarks about a one-state versus two-state solution. And that came in answer to a question in which he said, essentially, I'm looking at two-state, one-state, and I'd like the one that both parties like. I'm very happy with that one both parties like. I can live with either one. Now, this has led to endless speculation afterwards as to what it meant and what does this mean for the future. Now, I think what he was really saying in many ways was less than it appeared. I think what he was really saying was, look, I want peace. I want a peace that both sides agree to. And if both sides agree to it, I'm good with that. So two states, one state, whatever. It's up to you two. Now, people have taken this as meaning that the U.S. is moving away from a one state, rather from a two state solution. This is something that the U.S. has been committed to explicitly ever since, really since President Bush in 2002.
Well, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, went out and made a point of saying the United States is not abandoning the two-state solution. It's merely opening itself up to more possibilities. And I take your point, Rob, that part of what President Trump seemed to be signaling is he's less concerned about the substance of the deal, the terms of the deal. He's much more interested in the fact that he gets a deal that both sides can live with. But so let's talk a little bit about the one-state solution versus the two-state solution. Obviously, the two-state solution first was formally endorsed by George W. Bush when he was president, reaffirmed by Barack Obama. Most people who talk about this issue seem to see it as the only viable sort of outcome. But Mr. Trump is obviously questioning that assumption, as he's questioned a lot of other assumptions. How would a one-state solution work?
In short, it won't work. And the reality is that no one really ascribes to or subscribes to a one-state solution. The fear is, for both Israeli and Palestinian peacemakers, is that what may result is that in the absence of a peace agreement, you may have a one-state outcome in which the territory between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, the area that encompasses Israel and the West Bank, which is now ruled by Israel, going on 50 years this June. Israel occupied the West Bank and East Jerusalem during the June 1967 Six-Day War, that this will become an enduring reality. And then Israel will be forced to make a very difficult decision. If it is going to be one state and a Jewish state and a democracy, how do you square those things?
That gets you to the question of demographics, right? Because if you look at it right now, Israel proper has a population of about 8.2 million people. Three-quarters are Jewish, quarter Arab-Palestinian. The West Bank has about 2.7 million residents, overwhelmingly Arab-Palestinian. And the Gaza Strip is home to about 1.7 million people. So if they were all in one state, it pretty much breaks down the middle between Arabs and Jews. And that gets to the dilemma about the question of a democracy and being a Jewish state, correct?
That's right. I mean, when Israel occupied that territory in 1967, it was meant to be a temporary measure. UN Security Council passed Resolution 242, which was enshrined the concept of land for peace. And all peacemaking efforts since then have been based on that basic principle, land for peace. Left ambiguous was precisely what land. Would it be all of the territory, most of the territory? But the basic understanding internationally was it would be most of the territory. And the question would be also, who would get that territory? Because prior to 1967, Jordan had occupied it. With the Oslo Accords in 1993, Israel and the PLO recognized each other and agreed that they would resolve all these issues in the final disposition of Jerusalem, the settlements, the occupied territories in 5 years of negotiations. They missed the deadline, and we have been in that post-Oslo period ever since. Now, it was not specified in Oslo what the outcome of that five-year negotiation would be. The additive was when President Bush said that outcome will be a Palestinian state. On Wednesday, President Trump said, well, one state or two state. Now, the interesting part, as you note, is the following day, both U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley and the U.S. nominee to become ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, who is known to be an avid supporter of the settlement enterprise in Israel, has been a financial backer for him, also said the United States is committed to a two-state outcome. Well, this looks like a pretty clear walking back of what was an offhanded comment, but that has sent the world in a tiz after the president said it on Wednesday.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about settlement policy. Obviously, President Trump, or as candidate Trump, seemed to be a big supporter of Israeli settlements. As you noted, he has nominated David Friedman, who is clearly a very big backer of Israeli settlements, to be U.S. ambassador to Israel. However, since becoming president, President Trump seems to have walked back some of his earlier statements on settlement policy. Earlier this month, the White House warned Israel that new or expanded settlements on the West Bank, I'm going to quote here, may not be helpful. And this announcement came after Israel announced that it would build its first new settlement in the West Bank in years. And before I ask you to sort of explain Trump administration policy, maybe you could give us a short primer on settlements. What are we actually talking about here? I've heard a lot of discussion, for example, about settlements in terms of expanding and taking on new terrain versus settlements becoming more sort of dense in terms of more people living there, bigger buildings, taller buildings, what have you.
Look, ever since the 67 war that I alluded to, Israel has been building in areas beyond what was known as the Green Line, that armistice line that was drawn between Jordan and Israel, that went through the West Bank and divided Jerusalem. Jerusalem, the city, had been divided as a result of the fighting in the 1948 war, and where the fighting ended, the armistice line was drawn. And Jerusalem was a divided city, much as the way Berlin was, with a wall and barriers going through the middle of the city. After the 67 war, when Israel conquered the east side of the city.
And that's the old part of Jerusalem where many of the holy sites are, correct?
Correct. The holy sites are in East Jerusalem, and though after 1950, I'm sorry to throw so much history, but it's so critical to understand that Israel moved its capital to Jerusalem in 1950, and only, I think, three countries, not including, and the United States was not one of them, recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. But on the issue of settlements, the issue of settlements, generally speaking, often conflates building in East Jerusalem and the rest of the West Bank. Now, for Israelis, they don't. Israelis make a distinction between East Jerusalem, which was Israeli law was extended to, and Israel treats all of Jerusalem as their own, in contrast to the West Bank. The rest of the world sees those people who live in East Jerusalem, those Israelis who live in East Jerusalem, and those Israelis who live in the heart of the West Bank, all the same as settlers. And so that is one of the things that disconnects when you talk about settlers and settlements. So currently, today, when you talk about settlers, you have something roughly along the lines of close to 200,000 Israelis who live in East Jerusalem. Then you have another about 400,000 Israelis who live in what is called the West Bank. So together, they make up over 600,000 Israelis beyond the Green Line.
So when President Trump says to Prime Minister Netanyahu, "I'd like to see you hold back on settlements for a little bit," do we know which settlements he's talking about?
No, we don't. But let me just walk back one important point here. I was describing the distinction between Jerusalem and the West Bank. I think in many ways the visit on Wednesday was really as much about the past than it was as it was about the future. I think in many ways the visit was about trying to distinguish the relationship between President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu from that of the previous relationship between President Obama and President Netanyahu. And because settlements were such a divisive issue, culminating in the resolution that the U.S. abstained on in December, which essentially called settlements illegal, all and settlers illegal. And the way the resolution read, it meant that even those Israelis who were living in East Jerusalem are settlers living in violation of international law. This perception, which is widely shared by the world, is not one that Israelis feel. And I think that what President Trump was trying to do was move this issue of settlements out of the legal framework and into the political framework that Israelis think about it in. And so the hints that have been made in the run-up to the visit is that in a statement that President Trump's White House put out was basically do not expand settlements. So what does that mean? President Bush, 43, distinguished between land and settlers, basically saying don't take any more land, but the addition of settlers, what Israelis refer to as natural growth, was essentially acceptable.
So you could have a greater, what we, I guess urban planners would call urban density.
Correct. Because one thing that people fail to understand is when you look at the maps and you break down where Israeli settlers are in the West Bank, some 80% of the settlers live on just 4% of the land. And so the basically people who look at this problem and put forward solutions, those people who are professional peace processors, generally accept that for there to be a partition of the land, for there to be two states, will require there to be adjustments to the 1967 armistice line. And the proposals that have been put forward always call for essentially Israel to annex some of the West Bank territory, but then to compensate the Palestinians with other territory elsewhere. And so what I think we're talking about here is when people decry settlements is, will those settlements spread so much that it will make drawing a line between two states impossible? And that's the fear, I think, that President Obama was expressing. That is the fear that the international community expresses when they decry settlement activity. And I think what President Trump is trying to do is say, look, settlements are unhelpful. And that's where he clearly has resolved an ambiguity that had existed in his line of thinking up until now. You know, the fact that he had appointed a settler, the fact that he himself has given money to settlements, he's now walking that back and saying, you know what, settlements, not so helpful. And he said very explicitly to Prime Minister Netanyahu, I'd like you to hold back on settlements for a bit. That was a clear message to the Israelis. I want to see a walk back on settlement activity. You do not have a blank check. You do not have a green light to just continue building settlements.
To add land in terms of settlements. That's how you take it?
It's not clear. Essentially, what was hinted at was that they need, the two sides are now going to work to define what the understanding on settlements is. But again, I think the basic message was, I, President Trump, want to work with Israel to work together to work out what it means rather than try to impose it on you, as is perceived to be the case under President Obama.
Earlier on, you raised the issue of domestic politics and how this visit had important symbolism for both leaders. Tell me a little bit about sort of the current state of domestic politics in Israel. I mean, who is the constituency for Prime Minister Netanyahu? How do Israelis view this? I mean, there's a tendency to speak of countries as if they're monolithic and everyone has the same view. And we know from our own country that that's not the case. So sort of tease this out for us and give us a sense of sort of how Israelis view this issue.
Israel is a very divided country in which there's a lack of consensus on most issues. When it comes to the issue of the future of the West Bank and whether or not Israel should retain that territory or not, there's kind of a duality that exists. On the one hand, the majority of Israelis still support a two-state solution. And there they do not agree with those on the right who do not believe in a two-state solution. Where there's more of a consensus in Israel is the belief that the situation is not auspicious right now for the pursuit, completion of a peace treaty, and the implementation of a peace agreement. And so the real debate is about what do you do in the interim while time moves on? And the concern is that unfettered settlement activity will close the window or close the door, pick your metaphor, to a two-state solution, that there is a critical point at which Israel takes or settles enough of the West Bank. And also, it's not just about settlements. It's also about infrastructure like roads and other elements that just prevents the ability for the West Bank to be a viable, contiguous, sovereign West Bank Palestinian state in conjunction at some point with Gaza, if and when Hamas is removed and the Palestinian Authority is returned to Gaza. So Israelis are divided on this issue. Now, against this backdrop, Prime Minister Netanyahu leads a right-wing government, the head in which his party, the Likud, is the most centrist party in that coalition. But even his Likud party has largely lunged to the right. And so you have a number of people in his party who do not agree with the two-state solution, who are firm supporters of the settlers.
And he himself, in 2015, repudiated the two-state solution, then walked it back, correct?
Prime Minister Netanyahu has been very ambiguous on this point. It's sort of like the Mona Lisa winking at everyone. So in 2009, soon after President Obama came to power, Prime Minister Netanyahu gave a landmark speech in which he committed himself to this two-state solution. There's been a lot of questioning about his commitment to the vision and the degree to which that was just a way to keep the United States off his back. But what was interesting was On the eve of the visit, on Sunday, Prime Minister Netanyahu had a four-hour meeting with his cabinet, and he was called upon the more right-wing members of his coalition, primarily Naftali Bennett, who comes from another party called the Jewish Home, who called on him to repudiate the two-state solution, to not utter Palestinian state or two states when he went to Washington. According to press reports, Prime Minister Netanyahu told his cabinet, he said, no, I spoke to President Trump soon after he became president. I reaffirmed Israel's commitment to this two-state solution, and we cannot afford to get into a confrontation with this president. And against that backdrop, that's what makes it all the more remarkable that in the press conference, President Trump essentially walked away from what Prime Minister Netanyahu had been prepared for, which was a call to affirm the two-state solution. And I suspect that some of the subsequent American affirmations of the two-state solution that you referred to, Ambassador Haley and Ambassador-designate Friedman, was a way to kind of just squelch any debate about that and reaffirm the two-state solution, because it helps Prime Minister Netanyahu to have the two-state solution out there as a barrier he can't cross.
Okay, so Prime Minister Netanyahu has very complex coalitional politics in his government, and there are plenty of people outside the coalition who disagree with his policy choices. But I want to draw you up, Rob, on your point that many Israelis look and don't see current circumstances as ripe for doing a deal. They hope to have a deal someday. They don't see the circumstances as being ripe right now. That obviously raises the question, any negotiation is somebody on the other side of the table, in this case, the Palestinians. I'll note that this week, as Prime Minister Netanyahu was meeting with President Trump, that the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Mike Pompeo, was meeting with the head of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas. So I guess, what was that meeting about? Is it coincidental that it happened at the same time? And what is sort of the viewpoint for Palestinians looking at this meeting between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump?
The dispatch of CIA Director Pompeo to the West Bank to see President Abbas was no accident. It was a way of telling the Palestinian leader, we haven't forgotten you. You're on our radar screen. And presumably he told them, don't overreact to what you're about to hear. We're interested in a peace agreement. We are very much of the view that both sides have to agree to it. And that, in essence, gives President Abbas a veto over any kind of imposed solution that is anything but a two-state solution. So I think it was just meant to assure him. That said, Palestinians, by and large, were very distressed to watch the press conference from the White House and to hear President Trump talk about one state, two state, as if this could be something that could be walked back, or that somehow a two-state solution was no longer firm American policy. So they weren't happy about it. But I suspect that cooler heads in the Palestinian Authority recognize that that this is still very much early days.
Is there anything that we know of from the meeting that President Abbas has offered to the White House? I mean, again, are there any concessions, any openings, any indications that maybe we could create a ripe situation for negotiation?
Look, I think we're way ahead of ourselves here. I think President Trump was simply affirming an aspiration. I want a deal. I want to make a deal. And then that in and of itself is huge, because in comes someone who is a friend of Israel by his own profession, is someone who's been friends with Prime Minister Netanyahu personally for many years. He is someone who is friends to the settler movement, and he has said, no, more important to me, President Trump, than the settlements, more important to me is than keeping my friendship alive with Israel, is I want to do this deal. And there's a tension there, because on the one hand, he said, there'll be no daylight between me and Israel. Well, by definition, when you are the mediator to a deal, there's going to be daylight. This has always been the tricky part for the United States when trying to be both Israel's best friend, but also an honest broker. There's an inborn tension there. And again, I think that's where we get to what Prime Minister, or rather what President Trump was trying to say, was whatever they agree to, I'm good with. He was trying to say, I'm not going to impose my vision on them. But in reality, he's going to have to encourage them in certain directions, and that's why he said, hold off on settlements. And this is the interesting thing. In my experience, every Israeli prime minister needs the American president to draw certain red lines. And Prime Minister Netanyahu is no exception. Because especially from Prime Minister Netanyahu, who is, let's say, to the center of the rest of his government, his selling point, his value added as prime minister is to say, look, I know America better than anyone. I can handle the bilateral relationship better than anyone. So if you don't have me keeping the Americans at bay, you're going to be in trouble, you to the right of me. So I know where to give. I know where not to give. So I'm going to say things you may not like, but I have to do it to keep the United States on board. Now, that gets more tricky if the United States is not there standing up and keeping any limits on board. So put another way, and this is where I think things have gotten very interesting. For the first time, we may have a president that is saying to Israel, you decide what you want. We're not going to tell you what to want. And what that means is the Israelis have a greater responsibility and for the first time really have to struggle with their own vision of what kind of settlement they want with the Palestinians without the United States there telling them, you can go no further than this. And that's why I think we've entered a really new and interesting period that's going to force Israeli politics to become much more aggressive, much more robust in trying to grapple with these basic existential questions that have been at the root of the Israeli experience from its founding.
But how does that dialogue take place or come to a useful resolution if most Israelis aren't convinced that the circumstances are ripe to get a deal done?
It's a good question, and that's where I think the United States will have to help. And that's where I think, in my own analysis, where President Trump may be underestimating the difficulty of the situation. I think he may be falling into a mindset that that sees the situation between Israelis and Palestinians as having been somewhat static. And so, you know, President Clinton tried to negotiate a deal. President Bush tried to do a deal. President Obama tried to do a deal. I can do this deal. What that doesn't take into account is the situation may not be ripe for a deal in the way it once may have been. And I think what is necessary and what I think he's going to learn very quickly is that there may be steps that need to be taken in order to make the situation more ripe.
Who in the U.S. government is going to take the lead in this? I mean, I note that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was at the dinner on Tuesday night between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump. He wasn't at the meetings on Wednesday because he was jetting off to go to meetings in Europe. It's been reported in the press that no State Department representative was actually at, I think it was Wednesday's meetings. So who in the U.S. government, where's the locus of operational control for this? Obviously, in the Obama administration, at least in the second term, he had Secretary of State John Kerry, who ran up his frequent flyer miles jetting all around trying to do the deal. You knew who it was that was the point person. Any sense in the Trump administration yet as to where the locus of authority is going to be here?
President Trump was very clear in singling out his son-in-law as the person who's going to be running with this. Now, that's all well and good, but he's asked his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to do a lot. And as an advisor to the president sitting in the White House, it's one thing to give strategic guidance to a process, but it's another thing to actually roll up your sleeves and do it. I mean, this alone is a full-time job, and yet he's asked Jared Kushner to take on a whole host of foreign policy and domestic policy issues. Against that backdrop, there's another problem, which is, you know, this is still a very young administration. It's less than a month old. And many of the offices in the White House, in the National Security Council, and in the State Department are empty. The team hasn't yet been named. And so it's going to take some time to actually get going because the people simply aren't in place.
I'll just point out here, the Washington Post, in cooperation with a nonprofit whose name I'm now forgetting, has Interact, I think it's the Partnership for Government Service, something like that, of the 690 so odd most important executive appointments the president has to make. And of those, 661 have, I think as of yesterday, had not been made. And I'll just point that out because there are an awful lot of slots to fill, as you note. But not only that, the time between nominating somebody and their being confirmed by the Senate is quite substantial because you have to do all the vetting, then you have to have hearings. And the longer this goes, the harder it's going to be to get confirmation because the Senate's calendar is going to be taken up with lots of legislation. We have the forthcoming debt ceiling. We're going to have corporate tax reform, repeal of Obamacare. I mean, it's going to be a very crowded legislative agenda, so it is going to be a long time before a lot of those slots are being filled. One of the things that many people predicted President Trump would do very early on is move the embassy from Tel Aviv to East Jerusalem, and that hasn't happened yet. And in this week's meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu, President Trump sounded a lot less definitive on the topic than candidate Trump had been, merely saying that he'd love to see that happen. What's going on here, and to what extent is it significant that we might move the embassy?
Well, I think what has been most interesting is this essential walkback of the position by the president. In essence, what he is saying is, look, my heart is in moving the embassy, as I've looked into this, I recognize it's a lot more complicated than I realized.
And why is it complicated, Rob? I mean, because most people think of it, well, why can't the United States have an embassy in the capital that the Israelis recognize as their own?
It's complicated in part to our own making. The problem that exists is very profound because we adhere to a policy that is so out of sync with the realities as they exist in Jerusalem today. In 1947, when the United Nations established the legitimacy for there to be Israel, Security Council, UN General Assembly Resolution 181, it called for two states, a Jewish and an Arab state, to be created in what was then Mandatory Palestine. But interestingly, they called for Jerusalem to be separate, a corpus separatum, an entity separate that would not be sovereign under either state. That is still our policy today. And it has been updated a bit with the advent of the Oslo Peace Accords to say, when Israel and the Palestinians reach an agreement, we will support whatever it is they agree to. But in the interim, we have not updated our policy to reflect the fact that Israel moved its capital to West Jerusalem in 1950, and its government has run out of West Jerusalem ever since.
A moment ago, I said East Jerusalem. If the United States were to move its embassy from Tel Aviv, would it move it to East Jerusalem or West Jerusalem?
Well, it all
or
depends.
To be determined.
Well, will Jerusalem be the capital of one or two states? The general expectation is that if there was ever a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that Jerusalem will be the capital for both Israel and Palestine. And then it raises the question, would we have two embassies or just one embassy, perhaps straddling the border between the two countries? There are many different possibilities. You know, in theory, I don't think there's any reason we shouldn't move the embassy to West Jerusalem, recognize the embassy, Jerusalem as the capital. The problem is that doing that raises so many issues owing to the fact that Jerusalem is such a sensitive issue owing to its historic nature as the cradle of civilization for three monotheistic religions. It is so laden, it being holy to Jews, Christians, and Muslims. It will immediately raise the question, well, if you're putting the embassy in Jerusalem, does that mean you are recognizing Israeli sovereignty over all Jerusalem? That's the implication. Is it possible to come up with a formulation which you say, well, we are recognizing the Israeli capital in Jerusalem, but not recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of all of Israel, or all of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel? Perhaps, but it has to be managed in such a delicate way. And that means working with other vested interests in Europe, in the international community, in the Arab world, in the Muslim world.
Okay, let me draw you out on that. And I take it that the issue of moving the embassy can go under the heading of it's complicated. But I want to draw you out on sort of what other countries are thinking, saying, and might do about the current state of affairs between the Israelis and the Palestinians. I mentioned at the top of the podcast that you were the Quartet's mission head in Jerusalem. And so how are the EU, Russia, Arab countries reacting to what we're seeing right now? And does it matter?
Well, first of all, I think the most important thing here is that we have a new president, a new presidency. And so you have countries all over the world who recognize the critical role the United States plays in the world. And I don't know of any countries that want to run afoul of the new administration from the onset. And so as much as they may be at variance with the American position on Jerusalem right now, all the issues pertaining to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, at the same time, they don't want to get into an immediate conflict. And so I think the inclination, maybe this is just wishful thinking, is that many in the world will want to just simply first engage the administration, recognize that these are early days, that what the president is doing is expressing aspirations. And again, at the end of the day, the most important thing the president said was he wants a deal. And that's something the world wants. So they may have a bit of trouble with some of the things he said that seem to contradict or are in conflict. How do you want a deal, but at the same time say one state, two states? But I think that that means that governments will want to seek clarification and give it some time. They recognize this is a new administration. They recognize this is an administration that is just getting its feet, that is going through a certain degree of turmoil in its early days. And so, you know, they're not going to want to rush to judgment. I think they're going to have a lot of questions as various leaders come and meet with President Trump and meet with Secretary Tillerson and other senior officials. They're going to have a lot of questions about what American policy is on a whole variety of questions. One thing we didn't talk about today was Iran. And I think that was that's also a very critical issue that maybe didn't get as much prominence in the public remarks between President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu, but is one that is very much critical for the Prime Minister Netanyahu in coming here to Washington.
Did you see anything in that press conference or know anything from your contacts around town that was decided on the issue of Iran?
No, but I would point to one thing that I would be something to watch for. I've noted that whenever President Trump talks about Israel, the first thing he does is pivot to talking about the Iran deal. It's a bad deal. It's a terrible deal. That says to me that he has internalized that this Iran deal is bad for Israel. And when he thinks about how I, President Trump, want to be Israel's friend, it has to do with the deal. The issue, though, today is that for many in Israel, let's say in the Israeli security services, the national security establishment, the debate about Iran, the policy debate Iran, has moved on from the deal to the larger question about Iranian foreign policy. And so it's not clear that most Israelis actually want the deal ripped up. They may not like it. They see flaws in it. But they recognize that ripping up the deal is no longer perhaps the optimal outcome. What matters to them more right now is Iran's behavior elsewhere in the Middle East, its expansionist activities, its hostile activities, and the risk they see in the nuclear deal providing Iran greater access to international capital. That's what they're worried about. And that's not what President Trump talks about. So I think that's an area that I would look for some further policy development on. I suspect that when they met, Prime Minister Netanyahu focused on some of that. And in the Israeli comments, they have focused on Iran's expansionist behavior. I think the way that the Prime Minister Netanyahu tried to reconcile what may be competing priorities between Israel, which sees Iran as the number one threat in the region, and the Trump administration, which sees ISIS as the number one threat to American interests, is to talk about Islamic terror in general as an umbrella term that can encompass both Iran and ISIS and other Sunni terrorist organizations as a way to paper over what is really a change in a difference in emphasis. Because in reality, for Israel and most of the Arab states today, Most of the Arab Sunni states, the number one threat, well, still a threat, is not ISIS, it's Iran. And that's somewhere where there is a bit of difference in emphasis between the U.S. and the and Israel.
Well, I suspect, Rob, that when we're talking about Iran or we're talking about settlement policy or we're talking about the embassy move or we're talking about doing a peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians, a lot more is going to be happening in all of these dimensions. And I think if there's one takeaway I have from our conversation today is it's complicated. There are lots of things going on here. And I think it's probably useful for all of us to remember that we're just 4 weeks into a Trump presidency and the administration, its broader team, is going to have to grapple with all of these challenges. I simply want to say thank you for joining us, Rob.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
On that note, we'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. You can subscribe to the President's Inbox on iTunes and leave us a review. It really helps. Please note that opinions expressed on the President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Kevin Lizarazo with senior producer Jeremy Sherlich and recording engineer Dan Mudd, with special thanks to Audrey Bowler. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon on the President's Inbox.